So the talk tonight is around the issue of happiness. And partly because we got a note today asking about this, and partly because I don't know why, but I suddenly remembered an old friend of mine who one day came running to me. This was in India, and said, I've solved the problem. There's an equation. When I want is equal to what I get, then I'm happy. If when I want is more than what I get is less, then I'm unhappy. When I'm getting more than what I want, I'm also unhappy. So when they're two equal, the wanting and the getting, then I'm happy. And he said, that's an equation for life. So I said, well, it's a little bit primitive, isn't it? I mean, the I that wants is changing constantly. The wanting is changing constantly, and the what you get is changing constantly, so this equation can never work for more than 1 second. And he said, no, that's... he's now quite a famous professor in the University of California, and he's still actually saying the same thing, a lot more sophisticated, but he's more or less in the same line. Until today. It's true that mostly in our life we do not get what we want. Mostly our needs are huge. And more than that, there's some unpleasant trick that life plays on us. That when we want more, we seem to want more and more. That the wanting itself grows. The more we want, the more we seem to want. So there are all these demonic aspects to this. And if we start getting, we also get too much. I mean, just think, what would we feel if we went into a meal, we had a fantasy, I want this great meal. I pass by a restaurant and I'm hungry and it looks so good. And you go inside and you really want it and you enjoy it. Supposing someone, a magician, would wave a magic wand when you come out of that restaurant and say to you, right, now do it all again. Oh, I have to eat the same meal twice. I'm so full, I can't eat it now. Oh, I've got to go through the same again. So the same thing in the wrong place in the wrong time becomes a nightmare that you want so much. So everything is so difficult. This wanting business is so difficult. And then when you don't get... It's so difficult. And sometimes we get a glimpse of what life might be like without the wanting. I never forget when I was in Varanasi, also in India, in 1975. Every morning I used to pass a line of beggars. And they were in their place, in their station. One of the beggars in the line, this was near Asighat, had no legs and no arms, and he was in a box being pushed by someone else. And he was singing, and there was fire in this guy's eyes. His eyes were burning with light. He was singing all day. It was a phenomenon. Okay, you could say, well, he's singing for his money, but it wasn't that. This guy was singing from his heart, and every time we passed by, I just stopped there and look at this man. The joy, the happiness is not necessarily dependent on what it is that you get and what you don't have and what you do have and you don't have. I work with cancer patients, and sometimes you see people that are close to death or close to the biggest suffering, and yet there's so much joy. And maybe because of the closeness to the truth, or maybe because of the closeness to ultimacy, something bigger than us. But I've enjoyed with them deep joy in the most difficult moments of that you can possibly imagine, that no one wants. And sometimes people have said to me, "I'm so glad I had this cancer, because I woke up and I see that every moment is so precious and beautiful." So our issue is that we basically build our world on what we want. That's what we run our life on. We define our life on what we want. I need love. I need money. I need food. I need a job. I need respect. I need a society. I need peace. I need a house. I need it. And we are actually devoting, even if we often think it's a bit under the surface, if we examine what it is that motivates us, we'll find these things are there. And it's not only us, it's every ant and every cat and dog and fish is motivated largely by what's called the eight conditions. The eight conditions, the Dharma of the eight conditions, the eight worldly conditions. I want to be and not to not be. I want pleasure and not pain. I want to be loved or accepted and not rejected. I want to have and not to lose. And it brings us one-to-one. It brings us to neediness and wanting, and somehow our life is directed. Even if we have a moment of stopping all of that and peace, and we find ourselves back in that world again of the eight conditions. So it's very strong. And it's the comfort zone. It's the busyness with the castle of the Buddha. Before he left on his quest, he was in this castle, which is the island of comfort. And it was also a prison. And his father didn't want him to leave. And we are there in the Buddha's prison and the Buddha's castle and the Buddha's palace, because it all looks, if we're getting what we want, we do have food, it looks okay, and we feel life is beseda, kind of. But there is a something deeply unsatisfying about just running our life according to what we want. Deeply unsatisfying. And that's, I think, the true meaning of dukkha, of the Buddhist view of suffering. The word dukkha means not unsatisfying, unsatisfactory. Something is missing. Something is not fulfilling. It's a sense of constant dissatisfaction, and it isn't to do with what it is we're unsatisfied about. It's not to do with things. It's to do with something in us that just can't seem to get enough. We are guided by this wanting. There's a story, a famous Indian story about a king in the desert, and he was wandering in the desert, and all of a sudden he was terribly thirsty. He ran out of water. So he prayed and prayed to the gods, and the gods came to him and said, what's your problem? He said, I'm terribly thirsty. I need water. So the gods said to him, well, okay, I'll give you water. You have to give us half of your kingdom. So he said, oh, okay, take my kingdom. I must have water. So he got water, found a pool, and then he went on. And after that, after a while, he couldn't urinate, couldn't do pee-pee. And so he prayed to the gods, please open the channels, I have to do pee-pee. And I give you the other half of my kingdom, please just let me do pee-pee. So the god said to him, sure, give us the other half of your kingdom and we'll let you do pee-pee. But you should know that you've given your entire kingdom for something that comes into your body and goes out again. It's just something that comes in and goes out. So the conditions are endless, the difficulties are endless, and we find ourselves experiencing suffering. We live with suffering. We live with difficulty. And it's not just the physical pain that we may have if we're sick, changes in the body, that we want a better body, or we want the body that was, or we want the body that we imagine. It's all the psychological patterns that we have. The psychological issues that touch us, that trip us up, the patterns, the way we look at life through patterns, through issues, through incompleteness. And the way we escape, and the way we want to escape, and we need to escape, and the way we're always looking to escape, whether it's the television or the politics or the going out with the friends or whatever, there is a world of escape that we find ourselves running to. Or blame, or we blame ourselves, or we blame the other, or we go to psychologists and in order to blame our father and or mother, and we find a blame society, we blame the politicians, or we are throwing stuff out all the time to others, and this is all part of the dukkha, it's part of the difficulty, it's part of the unhappiness. And in some way the search for happiness tells us that we're unhappy. The need to be happy is a deep dukkha, that we have to be happy. Who says we have to be happy? We only have to be happy because there's something in us that doesn't let us be happy. It's like we are unsatisfied, so we are trying to be happy. And we don't see our vulnerability. We can't live with our vulnerability. So a deep truth that we gradually understand is that it's an impossible task to try and be happy by changing the conditions, by changing the situation, by changing the external world, by changing conditions will not bring us happiness. It will just bring us a different moment with a different problem. You know, we can be joyful, we can be happy, unhappy, but changing the conditions does not ensure enduring happiness. Changing the mind does. If we change the mind that perceives the conditions, we have a possibility for a happiness that stays. If we just change the conditions, we're setting ourselves up for another story with another kind of dukkha. We go to the restaurant, we're hungry, we go to the restaurant, change the conditions, that's fine, we eat. 5 minutes later, we have a problem of a different kind. Or someone tells us, go back to the restaurant and do it all again. We change the mind, we change the heart, and something there has become radically different with the same conditions. And that's, of course, the big message of the beggar without arms and legs. And the Buddha has a very beautiful model to describe the way this happens. He said, don't try and change yourself with force, bekoach, with force. Don't force yourself to be someone different, because you're then doing the same thing as you are all the time, trying to change the conditions, change the situation, through dissatisfaction, forcing yourself to try and be somebody else, is still in the same trip of the eight conditions. Instead of that, there is a nutritional model the model of nutrition, the model of what is it we feed in ourselves, what qualities of being do we feed, do we support, and what qualities of in ourselves do we reduce, do we stop paying attention to, do we stop giving importance to, what do we feed and what do we take the food away from, what fires do we feed and what fires do we stop to feed. This is different from a I'm no good, I have to share, I'm not happy, I have to get happy. I'm not happy, this is stopping me being happy, I have to kill it. This pathology is making me unhappy, I have to stop it, I have to cut it. Do nituach, do surgery. It's a nutritional model. And a nutritional model based on the mind. Namely, what you call the inclination of the mind, the type of mind we have, the direction of our mind, the tendency of the mind, nitya, the way, the inclination of mind is who we are. So if we want deep happiness, true happiness, we have to shift the inclination, the way our mind is working, the tendencies in our mind. And we shift it by feeding the goodness in us, feeding the purity, feeding that quality in us that is going to make us enduringly happy, constantly happy, but not depending on conditions. So let's examine a little bit what are the roots of happiness in the Dharma? What does the Dharma say about enduring happiness? And it's not an easy one step instant soup kind of prescription. There are many aspects to this, and this is a Dharma way of life, rather than a prescription for happiness, which to some extent will be the same thing as what I said, an instant solution for happiness, namely another condition that makes us happy. Like we go to a kind of instant kind of spiritual package and we get happy. It's not like that. The Dharma is much, in a way, much richer, much bigger, also more complex. It's a way of life. So one aspect of this way of life is the aspect of sila, of purity of action. And we already talked about it in the first evening, when Yonatan talked about purity of action. Purity of action, how we are in the world, how much damage we do to the world, or how much generosity we do to the world, or how much love we act in the world, or is a powerful source of our happiness. And sila is fundamental. That is, right action, how we act, not harming others, not harming ourselves, not harming the world, helping, protecting, mothering ourselves and others is a powerful source of happiness. What it does is it throws seeds of karma. It, in a way, repairs something. It is tikkun olam. It repairs. It throws seeds of a different kind. We can't expect that because we throw these seeds of goodness, we're going to be happy. We can't expect it. It doesn't work like that. But if we keep throwing seeds of goodness into the world all the time, they don't go any special place, they go everywhere. The seeds of goodness that we throw, that we sow, lizroah, the harvest, the harvest, that we, a katsir that we get, we don't know where it'll come, we don't know how it is, we don't know what it will look like. But something changes in our life that if we keep, if you like, aligning ourselves, towards goodness, then goodness happens. To others, to ourselves, it's not clear, to our relationships with our friends, something happens in the life. The thing shifts. It feeds, again, the feeding goodness. So this is why it's always there as part of spiritual life. Authentic spiritual life cannot be based on harming. Which is why very, very sensitive, I personally and others are very, very sensitive about the issue, for example, of abuse. Nitzul of abuse. Abuse, for example, is so common, money. That you pay this and you get a spiritual truth. You pay a bit more, you get two spiritual truths. You pay extra and you get ones where you get special clothes you wear and you go close to the guru. You pay a bit more and the guru might invite you for tea. What was this? This is karma, this is good, this is spreading seeds of goodness. So be very careful about the as much as you can about the spiritual life. Doesn't mean to say we're still human beings, we still fall down, everybody does. But we align ourselves, mechavenet atzmenu, we are running along. We incline the mind, means inclining is that nice word, it means bending the mind. We bend the mind towards goodness in our life. And we are more likely to be happy because goodness is more likely to happen to us. But we don't know and we can't guarantee. It's karma. Karma is bigger than us. Karma made us, so we can't say we control any of it. So that's on the one side, and it's not to be forgotten, I think. And sometimes it is the practice. Forget meditation. It's like traditional to actually practice goodness. And traditional in the East, not to do meditation for years sometimes in monasteries or in teachers who say, no, don't do meditation. Just go out and work in the slums of Calcutta first. Just go out and help others. Just go out and be generous. Just give yourself. Clean the monastery. You know, first start cleaning the monastery for a couple of years. Then we'll think about meditation practice. So it's a very essential part of our existence on this planet is seeds of goodness that we sow and purity kind of happens in the world, in our world. And another sort of preliminary that we started with in the first evening was the aspect of the refuges. And the refuges are close to devotion. It's close to devotion. It's close to love. So we don't we don't have a statue of the Buddha here, and we all bow and we go through bhakti. It's not bhakti of this kind, but there is devotion, and the devotion to the Dharma, the devotion to the truth, devotion to something bigger than us. And that's the symbol of that is the refuge. I take refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. It's a very big thing. It's not the Buddha as a person. There's no pictures. And it's not that. It's not, at least not in our tradition. You'll find it much more in the Tibetan tradition. There's much more very obvious devotion to pictures and so on. But not in this particular tradition. But there is devotion. It's just devotion to something very big. Namely the truth, the Dharma, the big consciousness that we have in us and in the universe and in others. It's a devotion to something big, Dharma, the truth, the devotion to liberation. So it's there. And I think if we take refuge in the spiritual life, it leads to happiness. It's another source of happiness. But the biggest source of happiness is in the purity of mind, is in the purification, tihur, of our mind. And the Dhammapada, it's a text, a collection of kind of important small sayings said that it's a one said or more or less a one-to-one relationship with purity of mind. If your mind is pure, then happiness follows you just like a cart follows an ox. Just like a cart is following the ox, so happiness comes with a pure mind. So the pure mind is really the number one practice for us. And we started. And what we started is practice of concentration. We have 2 days in which we practice steadiness of mind. We brought all the scattered mind that all over the place, we bring it down and we sit. All the movements of the body that's constantly restless and has to move every minute and thinks what next and what to do and why, and another telephone call and another, there's nothing much happening, I'll turn on the TV and stop. We just stop. And this is the beginning of the meeting with inner peace, this stopping. And in this stopping and in the steadiness of mind is the potential for happiness, or one potential for happiness. Many of us don't feel it. But our body stopped and our mind's still carrying on at the Maya Kamash. So we don't feel inner peace, we don't feel it, we don't notice it yet. But I don't think we can expect that. Because if we've been running for 20, 30, 40 years, how can we expect to stop in 2 days? It's not like that. And so part of us has stopped, indeed, namely the body. For 45 minutes, we stop the body, mostly. But it's not so easy to stop the mind. And in a way, we really don't need to stop the mind. But I'll come to that. But at least we just can be aware that the whole thing, we can't stop the whole mind body all in suddenly, unless we take some kind of anesthetic someone knocks us on the head. It's like stopping the Titanic, you know, a big ship going, and it takes ages to stop. And we like that. And bits of us stop, like the body, and bits of us keep going. There's a cartoon once I saw about a woman in meditation for 45 minutes. And she's sitting there quietly, but her mind is racing and running, and mind is racing and running, and there are fantasies and what will happen and why. I can't take it, and it's so difficult. And at the end of 45 minutes, and she's like this, the teacher comes to her and says, "Wasn't that relaxing, my dear?" it's not so easy. It doesn't come all at once. We learn it step by step. Inner peace can't be obtained. Like nirkosh, to obtain it so easily, and it's mostly because of the habits of our mind, and we are running up against big habit energy of our minds and our bodies, and so against that habit energy we're struggling sometimes. But slowly, slowly, things do get easier, and you may have experienced, it may only be a moment of just the simplicity of breathing. Here I am, taking my place, sitting in this quiet space, not harming anybody, minding my own business, and there's a breath or two, and I'm just there with the breath. And it's not me breathing with all my problems that I should be doing and I shouldn't, and I didn't have money, and I didn't have money, blah, blah, blah. It's just a breath. It's not me, 60-year-old, 50-year-old, 70-year-old, pain, the body not working very well. It's just a breath. It doesn't have all that stuff in it, this breath. And that's a moment of peace. Even if we don't appreciate it so much, that's a moment of peace. It's a moment where we're connected to ourselves, where things come home, and in a way we arrived in a moment of truth, and less scattering, and less projections, and less busy doing things, and less restlessness, and less running, and less fighting, and so on. There is a quality in the breath itself of releasing, of bringing us happiness. In many of the suttas, it discusses this. I breathe in and I breathe out and I release. I let go. I breathe out and I release. I let go. Just a sense of, breathing is source of our life. It's a source of something, you know, essential and deep in us, and we are connecting to our source, and we let go. All the stress can just go in that moment. And if we want to imagine a moment in our ordinary life, just putting this picture of two or three breaths that we experienced here, we're sitting in our place, and just, actually, when anyway do we sit 45 minutes in our ordinary life? Even that is something. It's like, it's serious. We really sit 45 minutes in our ordinary life, still and quiet. It's already something. But if we imagine a situation like an argument with our parent, and we imagine the argument of with our parent, or we're impatient and waiting in a line and we just get fed up and we're late. Just imagine that situation, how much unhappiness it brings, how much stress is there from the conditions that are not right, that don't satisfy us. Conflict, restlessness, impatience, stress. Imagine how much those two breaths could actually make a difference. In the middle, if we're in the middle of argument and fighting and angry, and imagine that we could just do the same thing. Take two breaths and release everything. That's the homeopathic amount, in a homeopathic dose of inner peace. Small dose, but it's inner peace. We bring to any situation, it changes the situation. Right? So that's where the stopping is important for us. And the stopping, if you consider how much pain there is in the fight and in the argument or in the stress or in the impatience, and what two breaths will do, there is joy. There is happiness in that. But the other part of it, of purification, it's not just about quietness. And a lot of people think meditation is about stopping. Firstly, it's not really about stopping. It is about calming. It is about being less burning up. But it's not really about just stopping. If so, as I say, we could take a good dose of some nice drugs, get very much stopped, and we've done our job. Meditation was happened. It's not just about stopping. We stop in order to see. We stop in order for things to come to the surface. We stop in order for us to be awake and to see things. And that's the second part of the practice. So it's not just stopping. Stopping is great, and it does gives us some joy and it helps our happiness. But there is a much deeper place. Stopping is also a condition for freedom. We stop and things happen. Many of us stopped and we saw our mind, maybe more clearly than we've seen it for years. it's a mess, this mind. It's full of stuff. It's full of junk. It's like a rubbish heap that we've collected all our life. Big pachashpa. All our life we could thrown stuff inside, 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 thrown. And then we stop and we look inside. Oh, my God. That's me? I can't believe it. But it's part of it's the beginning of something very important. It's the beginning of purification. We can't purify the taher without seeing what it is to purify, to clean, to let go of. We have to see before we can let go of. Otherwise, we don't know what to let go of. So we have to see our inner world. And then we can begin to touch it, to do something with it, to free ourselves, to work with it. It becomes the raw material, the chomer gelem. It becomes the raw material that we have to work with. So stopping is the first stage. Not only is it helpful for us to be happy, but it's the first stage. Not only the first stage, it's constantly part of our practice. Never mind until the end of the life, the Buddha was practicing stopping as well as purification. The stopping goes on and on and on. It gets deeper and deeper and deeper. But it's also about seeing. So what we see when we stop is the mess. What we see is our history. What we see is the rubbish bin. What we see is who we are. We see our mind and it's a mess. We see our body and it hurts. We see our desires and they're going all over. I wish I was somewhere else. Now I want a cup of coffee. Why can't I go and have a good, decent coffee? And you know, we see the stuff coming up. And that's important because the second part is looking in the mirror. Meditation is about stopping and about looking in the mirror. And both of those things can be very, very deep, can go a long, long, long way. The stopping can go into deep states of stopping, and the seeing in the mirror can go into deep states of seeing our consciousness. And we've only just begun. We tend to see the most difficult things first. When the seeing happens, we tend to see our mind and it's a mess. We tend to see our, what you might call, not perfect, our imperfections, our what the Buddha called the stains on the cloth, aktamim on the cloth. And slowly, slowly, with practice that we're going to be talking about more and more during this retreat, we begin to work with this material. We begin to clean this material. We begin to let it go. We begin the process of transformation, which is vipassana, seeing and letting things go. And we will talk about this later. And when things are let go in us, when patterns and obsessions and the sources of difficulty and the sources of pain, when they're let go, every little bit of letting go of our stuff allows more joy to come. And this is the place in the transformation is the deepest source of happiness. And that's really what the Buddha meant when he said, pure mind, happiness follows like a cart following a horse. This is really what he meant, because this is the essence of the Dharma. The essence is purification of mind. That means cleaning the mind and letting go the stains on the cloth. And I have a quote here from a Buddhist text. So he says, the Buddha says, what, monks, are these imperfections that stain the mind? And he gives a whole list. And he says, greed and holding on is an imperfection that stains the mind. Ill will means not kindness, anger, revenge, or putting down people, or putting down ourselves, a dominating attitude, that means self-ego, envy, greed, and lack of sila, and so on, conceit, vanity, and not seeing things, negligence, being careless, etc. These are imperfections that defile the mind. And then someone that is able to, in part, the Buddha said, not completely, but in part, to give up these imperfections of the mind, he person would consider in this way. These imperfections of the mind, these stains on the cloth, have in part been given up, been thrown out, been released, been let go of by me. And at that point, I would gain inspiration in the meaning of the Dharma. I would begin to understand the Dharma. And understanding the Dharma means understanding truth, seeing things clearly, seeing the truth. Joy and happiness arises connected with the Dharma. Joy and happiness arises connected with deeper truth in us. And when we are glad and joy is born in us, in one who is joyful, the body becomes peaceful. And one whose body becomes peaceful feels contentment, I would say shalva, pleasure and contentment. And in one who feels content, the mind becomes concentrated. So here is some very interesting final comment, that all the two, the stopping and the seeing, actually become one. And we'll maybe talk about that later. But joy brings concentration and inner peace, and inner peace brings joy. So there is a cycle here where they're all connected. The Buddha said one of the main help to concentration, to sitting, to quietness, to inner peace is joy. And one of the results of concentration, of inner peace, is joy. So joy brings concentration or peace, peace brings joy. They are in cycling around each other. The happiness that is beyond dukkha, and I should say here, by the way, that there's another word called sukha, and dukkha is suffering or dissatisfaction, and sukha is satisfaction and pleasure. So dukkha and sukha really are two movements in our life. We want no dukkha and lots of sukha. But we're beginning to talk about a happiness or a shalva, a contentment, which is deeper than dukkha and sukha, which is not pleasure, which is not having what you want. It's a deeper happiness. And this comes with a more liberated mind, with a freer mind, with a mind that is... what comes when the stains on the cloth are cleaned? What comes is truth, is wisdom, is awareness. And what is this awareness? How does it look like? So there's another quote I want to... So the Buddha says, what are the many kinds of joy based on letting go? When you see things as they actually are with proper wisdom, that all forms are impermanent and subject to change, then joy arises. And joy like this is called joy based on renunciation, on letting go. In other words, when we drop our baggage and we see things as they really are, we see the flow of life, we drop our heavy self, our heavy sense of the burdens that we carry through our life, and we see that everything is dancing and everything is changing and everything is flowing, including ourselves, There's a liberation in that that brings joy. The Buddha calls it joy of renunciation. Renunciation means vitua. It doesn't mean we have to not have things. Renunciation, vitua, doesn't mean we have to throw out the Frigidaire, throw out the... sometimes it might be a good idea. I mean, here in the retreat, we live more simply, and I think it's a good thing for us, although some people might find it a little difficult. But I think it's important to know that we don't have so much dependence on so much. And it's quite a good lesson for us. But this is not what the Buddha meant. The Buddha meant renunciation, the joy coming from letting go, from simplicity of being deeply being in the truth, that everything is flowing and I'm part of that. And I'm sure that's partly the insight of these cancer patients that I had blessing to contact with and to be with, who, when they felt their life passing, just the response was joy, which is paradox, but not according to the Buddhist teaching. The Buddhist teaching is when you're close to the truth of the passing of things, the arising and disappearing, the everything flowing, it's a joy, it's a dance. You see, you and the life are one dance, which may not last very long. It doesn't matter. I think joy, in the end, is default condition of life. You know what I mean? Default, brerat mechtal. That's joy. All living beings, I think, have as a default, as an underlying base, joy. On there are all the stains on the cloth that hide the joy, the stains, the tamim, the imperfections, as the Buddha said. So just to give you a small story, one time the Buddha and his one or two monks were walking in the forest, and suddenly they heard someone giggling and laughing at the top of his voice, right? Far in the forest, giggling and laughing, giggling and laughing. And the Buddha said, "This is interesting. Go and find out who it is there that's so happy and just giggling and laughing all the time." So the monk went off and heard the story of this a man giggling and laughing who was a monk. And he came back to the Buddha and reported. And he said, "Look, I found a monk, one of your monks, sitting under a tree, laughing and giggling and laughing and giggling. So I asked him, 'What are you laughing about?' He said, 'I used to be a king. When I was a king, I had everything. I had gold and everything. I had servants, I had castles, I had kingdom. And I was so miserable. I was worried all the time that they would kill me. I had guards in my bedroom, in case someone would come in the night and kill me and take my treasure. I had guards outside. I couldn't go anywhere alone. I had people protecting me. I was anxious every minute. My life was a misery. I left it all, and I came to the forest, and I just practiced. And what makes me happy is that my mind roves means walks in the world just like a deer that's walking about eating grass. Yeah, dear Ayal, that's just walking about grazing the grass.'" And it's such a beautiful image of the joy that comes from dropping the baggage. Your mind, free of these stains on the cloth, is like a deer that just walks about eating grass. And it's a picture, it's an image, beautiful image from the ancient text of what this joy is like. And to close, I also want to read a small poem from Hafiz. And thanks to Bat-El that gave me this book. It's called "The Fish and I Will Talk Together." Once in a while, the fish and I will talk. In the silent language, we look into each other's eyes and smile. And the fish often say, "Hey, Hafiz, we see you know the joy of our existence. We see you have discovered how meditation can free you from land, from money, and from the mind, from the whole thing. And like us, it lets you party all day in God." So with that, we'll finish. Let's take a couple of moments of silence.